Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Connolly, and Judge Larkin. The Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, Council. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here on our second case on this oral calendar this morning, and it is A21-1273, State of Minnesota, Respondent versus Carlos Aaron Jimenez, Jr., Appellant. Council, this hearing is being conducted by Zoom. There'll be an audio recording of it later on our public website. Each of you has, as I think you know, 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And at the start of your arguments, if you could please, each of your principal arguments, state your name and the party representative. And if you are ready to go, counsel for appellant, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Carlo Jimenez Jr. While a closing argument need not be colorless, the case law prohibits a prosecutor from making certain types of arguments. A prosecutor cannot comment on a defendant's failure to present evidence. A prosecutor cannot say that a defendant concocted his testimony. And a prosecutor cannot disparage the defense, misstate evidence, or attack the character of the accused. The prosecutor here broke all of these rules, and the state cannot meet its burden of showing that that misconduct did not affect Mr. Jimenez's substantial rights. So for these reasons, we would ask the court to reverse his conviction and remand for a new trial. Beginning with the first type of misconduct, the prosecutor here commented on Mr. Jimenez's failure to present three different kinds of evidence. Now, the reason a prosecutor cannot make those comments is because it shifts the burden to the defense and suggests that a defendant has a burden to present evidence. There were three different types of—
Mr. Donovan, let me ask you this. Let's assume this is the hypothetical. It's murder, and the defense is an alibi, i.e., I was with mom. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the defendant testifies to that and says, you know, I was with mom that night. Okay. And mom never testifies. And that's it. I mean, he just gets on the stands, I was with mom, and, you know, that's his alibi defense, and it's based on what he said, and there's nothing else. Mm-hmm. What can the prosecutor say in closing about that? Can the prosecutor say, where's mom? Or, I mean, could the prosecutor say, well, don't believe him, mom didn't testify? I assume you would agree the prosecutor couldn't say that, right?
Correct. I think that's what Karen says, is Karen is clear that you can't say, where is this alibi witness?
But can the prosecutor say, the only testimony that provided from an alibi was the defendant, and he has a motive to lie? Can the prosecutor say that in closing argument?
I don't think the first part. I think it gets a little trickier on the second part. I understand it is a—
We get this all the time. You know, the defense has said something, you know, whatever it is, and then the prosecutor, says something in response to that. And then we get into this, oh my God, you know, the line has been crossed. And I have to admit, you know, in looking at these cases, I have difficulty finding, well, what can you say and what you can't. So I'm trying to get, I assume the defendant couldn't, the prosecutor couldn't say, well, you know, defendants all lie and he's lying this time. But when the defense is presenting a defense of some kind, I, in this case, you know, it was the letter. What can the prosecutor say about that? And what was specifically wrong in this case? I mean, the prosecutor didn't say, where's the letter, right? You know, don't believe him. He never showed us the letter.
I think that's what the prosecutor did say in this case, though.
Where did he say that?
At the very top of page 127, the second line, well, where is this letter? Who has seen this letter?
No. Well, first of all, that was in cross-examination, right?
No, that's in closing argument. He's asking in cross-examination.
Well, isn't it both?
Letter. He's asking cross-examination.
Where is the letter that you said came with that check? Answer, I don't remember any of that. Question, and then he says some other things. Question, where is the letter? Answer, oh, letter, I don't know where. So are you saying that that was improper cross-examination?
I raised misconduct only in closing, not in cross-examination. Okay. And the question on page 127 is where the prosecutor says, well, where is this letter? That's at the top.
But isn't the prosecutor specifically referencing something that your client responded to in his testimony at trial?
The problem with this sort of argument is it maybe to, yeah, sort of a lot there. I'm going to try and give you a spectrum and hopefully get you to a good answer. I think if we sort of look at a couple
answer for you, I'm not so sure it'd be a good answer for Ms. Posse, but what the hell?
How about a satisfactory answer?
How about the right answer under the law? Let's all hope we're striving for that.
I'll try to do a couple of them there. I think it starts with if there was no testimony and it was just an attempt to sort of poke holes in the case, I think that's race where you say, well, maybe someone, you know, maybe he got a letter. And if he didn't testify and the attorney said that, and then the prosecutor said, there's no letter, I think that's okay. That's the comment on the theory. I think if you talk about the evidence, you can certainly talk about his testimony and say, you know what, he testified that there was a letter. It's really a question of credibility. There's a whole instruction for how do we judge credibility? You know, does he have more to lose? Does he have less to lose? Is it reasonable compared to the other evidence? But the reason why a question here is problematic is because it's talking about a physical object that the defendant did not present as evidence. And it's asking the jury about that. Where is this letter? It's grouping them in. One person in this room has seen this letter. It's making it all seem like that. Maybe a different way to look at it is sort of in the civil context, there's the burden of production and burden of persuasion. And I think what Karen speaks of is it's not just burden shifting on persuasion, but it suggests that a defendant has a burden to produce some evidence. It suggests that he has a burden of production, that he should have presented this letter, that he should have presented evidence about this phone call, that he should have presented evidence about what he was doing, and he didn't. And the problem is that it's putting in the jury's mind that he doesn't have this letter, and that's the reason why they should find him not credible. I mean, the problem with an argument like this is that it's very effective. It works. That's how outside of a courtroom, people want to decide things. People want to say, well, where is the letter? You don't have a letter.
You know, and that's a fair point, Mr. Donovan. But I mean, I'm looking in rebuttal of appellant's closing argument, the prosecutor stated, for the entire time this case has been pending, there was no mention of this letter that appellant, that was legitimate. Not even to say, I'm sorry, I threw the letter away, but there was this letter and it made, you know, something look real to me. Do you know why that just came up today? Because he just thought of it today. I leave it to your own common sense. I mean, that I think is different from saying, which I think would have been appropriate, his whole defense is based on the letter that he supposedly got. He never introduced that letter. He's guilty. Now that I think crosses the line because that's suggesting that he did have a burden to produce the letter, but I'm not so sure the portion of the rebuttal closing argument crosses the line. Now what, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I find this all very confusing, but why did the portion of the rebuttal that I quoted crosses the line?
I think the portion of rebuttal that you quoted crosses actually two different lines.
Okay.
I think one of the lines that it crosses is by saying he just thought of it today, because another type of misconduct is saying that a defendant just concocted his testimony and saying that he just made it up there is a second kind of misconduct. The other thing is it's also referencing what he's done for the last 2 years, which is something that was brought up earlier as well in the closing argument. What have you done for the last 2 years? It's relevant that he hasn't done anything. He doesn't have to present any evidence about what he's done. Quite frankly, I'm not sure what he was supposed to have done in those 2 years. It's 2 years because he's charged in October of 2019 and then trial happens here. And that's the 2 year period. I mean, is his attorney supposed to tell him to go talk to the cops about this? And even if it's favorable, is that going to then come in? The state won't want to have that evidence in. He can't bring in self-serving hearsay. So I think that part in the rebuttal is actually two other different types of misconduct. One is about producing evidence of what you've done for 2 years. One is about saying that you've concocted this testimony. But as far as what you can say about this evidence. Again, there's credibility factors that the jury is given. You can argue about those credibility factors, but when you start saying, where is this? Who is that? That is the sort of comment that crosses the line, because it's implying that a defendant has a burden of producing some sort of evidence to support his theory, to support his testimony. That's the Johnson case.
The prosecutor says, do employers pay you in cashier's check? Do employers send you a bunch of cashier's checks? Now, I don't have a problem with that. Do you have a problem with that?
No, I think that's reasonable.
Okay. Defendant says, nope, there was this letter that was with it, made it all seem legitimate. Well, where is this letter? Who has seen this letter? One person in the room has seen this letter. Now, does that last part qualify? I'm wondering, that goes to an attack on his credibility. You know, the only person who's seen this letter is the defendant. Why should we believe him? It's in his interest to say there's a letter. I mean, why wouldn't I view it in that context, as opposed to the context is, oh my God, you're telling me he has to produce this letter and that violates, you know, all the rules. So why am I wrong?
You're wrong because it's still telling the jury that his credibility is, they can judge his credibility based on whether or not he can meet a certain burden of production that doesn't exist because he has no burden of production. And so when you're telling the jury, where is this letter? I can't think of a better example of misconduct by suggesting that a defendant has a duty to present evidence when you're literally questioning where it is. You're not just discussing his testimony. You're asking where it is. You want the jury to ask that question. It's saying the quiet part out loud. Of course, you want the jury to be thinking that for his credibility, but you can't introduce it to the jury to then say, why don't we all think about this? Let's all question if we should believe him because he failed to meet a burden that, again, is not real, does not exist. He doesn't have to prove anything. He doesn't have to present anything. But you start introducing these ideas.
Can the prosecutor say anything about the letter?
Absolutely, the prosecutor can.
What can he say or she say?
You know, I think there's part that towards the end that I think gets a little closer. I still don't know it's perfect, but when the prosecutor is saying, this is the first full paragraph on page 129, we look at it. Did the defendant know the check was forged? Use your own common sense. Does the story make sense? Those are, you know, fair game. I was waiting for money from CNH and I got a bunch of checks. And here's this one cashier check that has absolutely no notations on it. I have a letter, but I don't have that letter anymore. And maybe that letter didn't even say CNH. I think the last part is maybe a little questionable. I think he just said he didn't remember versus creating this equivocation. But that's more of a fair game because you are not then calling the jury's attention to his failure to present it. You're discussing his testimony, but you're not saying, but you also need to show us this. That's the problem, is it's in reference not just to his theory, but to a physical object. And I think, you know, maybe skipping just ahead for a moment on this, part of the problem with that is that this is not the sort of thing that an instruction is necessarily going to cure either, because the jury was instructed at the before closing about burden of proof, but it was not instructed that he did not have a burden to present evidence. The only time the jury is talked to about, you know, what we consider a burden of production is at the very start of voir dire on the beginning of page 21. That's the only time the jury is told he doesn't have to present evidence. Later on, they talk about, well, you know, the state still has to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, but they're not, you know, informed that he does not have to present any evidence in support of his theory. I think another part of that is the instruction only gets you so far. There are other types of misconduct here, and they aren't given instructions about that. The jury is not instructed to ignore attacks against his character. The jury is not told, don't listen if the prosecutor says he made up his story. So an instruction really only gets you so far in this case. This is not a case where there's a lot of...
Well, they are told that, you know, evidence is what the witnesses hear and say. Evidence is not what the attorneys say. I mean, that's a, you know, would that be a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. But they're not normally in cases where they talk about instructions about burden shifting. There isn't...
But you'd like the instruction to be, and for God's sakes, don't pay any attention to what the prosecutor says you know, just listen to what I'm saying? Is that
No. What I meant more was that the cases about instruction are about the burden to produce evidence once, not cases about concocting a story. If you want to set that as a new jig, I'd be happy to hear the results of a survey.
Well, I'll talk to Judge Reyes. He's on the rules committee. We'll see what we can do.
Sure. I see that I'm running out of time. So I think at this point, we would just ask that you reverse his conviction and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for respondent, go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. Juliana Passy, Assistant Candy White County Attorney on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota. Your Honors, in this case, the prosecutor fairly responded to the defense arguments and the defense theory of the case, which were clear from the opening statements, made clear through cross-examination of the state's witnesses, as well as the introduction of the defendant's testimony. And then again, in closing arguments, the prosecutor didn't commit prosecutorial misconduct, and therefore the state would request that this court affirm the conviction of Mr. Jimenez. I think it's Judge Connolly's questions and discussion with Mr. Donovan make it clear, this why we're here is this came up because of the arguments that were made by defense counsel in this case and the evidence that he chose to introduce. He chose to introduce his client's testimony that said, I got this letter. I did all I possibly could to try and verify that this letter was authentic. I made this phone call from this letter to try and make sure that this was legitimate. And this is the defense theory that's going on in pervading this case. And the prosecution is merely responding to that theory of the case in closing argument by making the statements that she did.
Ms. Passy, I have some sympathy because, one has to say something in response to what the defendant is arguing. But what about Mr. Donovan's point that when the prosecutor says, well, where is this letter? Who has seen this letter? One person in this room has seen this letter. I mean, doesn't that come close to saying that the defendant had to introduce that letter if we're to believe him?
Your Honor, I think it goes back to we're talking about the credibility in the context of this statement overall. I think the defense is urging this court to, let's look at this one little statement here in the overall paragraph. If you read the paragraph, she's directly talking about the defendant's statements in cross-examination when he was asked about where this letter is. And she's saying, I asked him where this letter is. He says he doesn't know. No one's seen this letter. So I think it's, if it's not error and if it's not, if that's not what's being challenged and the defense is not challenging the asking of that question in cross-examination, it seems not erroneous for the prosecutor to be able to comment on the testimony in this case that he doesn't know where the letter is. No one else has seen the letter in the closing argument. The prosecutor is.
But wouldn't it have been better? As I said, I find these all very confusing. But wouldn't the better practice have been, now let's talk about this letter, and then the prosecutor could have just, to the extent possible, quoted what precisely the defendant said about the letter. And wouldn't that sort of, because then you're just saying what he said, and how can you get in trouble by just quoting what the defendant said? It's his own words, as opposed to doing this, which, one could argue fairly that, taken out of context, this sounds like if you want to believe him, he should have produced this letter, and since he didn't produce this letter, guilty he is. Now, why am I wrong?
Your Honor, I would agree that that's probably would be better practice to say to quote exactly what he said. However, the fact that that's not what the prosecutor did doesn't change us somehow into a case of prosecutorial error. I think going back to the race case, you know, there the prosecutor commented on the defendant's failure to introduce evidence of vandalism of some life rafts, which was part of the case. And the court said it's okay. Maybe it's not, maybe it might not be the model of propriety, but it's not error for the court, for the prosecutor to make such comments in that case. And I think it's the exact same thing here. Maybe there's better ways of doing it. Maybe what Your Honor suggested would have been a better and a cleaner manner to talk about this letter. But the fact that the prosecutor is saying, hey, this is the defense theory. They haven't, you know, this their defense theory is about this letter. The only one we hear about from this letter is Mr. Jimenez. He's the only one who's seen this letter. Where is this letter? We don't know. I think is fair given the what the Supreme Court said in the race case, as well as the other case law. I would agree with Your Honor that these cases do seem kind of messy, and there needs to be a line. But the prosecutor has to be able to comment on the defense theory and what evidence there is and is not in supporting the theory. And here it's the letter, which there was no evidence of other than the defendant. I think the, you know, the Gassler case too, a little bit different context, but you know, that case again says that it's not misconduct for the prosecution to highlight the lack of evidence supporting the defense theory. And again, that's what this is that the prosecutor saying this, there's no evidence supporting the defense theory. He wants you to believe that he did not have to open that door, but he opened the door from the very start of this case by talking about my client's going to testify and he's going to tell you that he took every possible step to try and legitimize this letter or this check that he got before he in fact cashed it. So how could he have the intent to defraud? Going a slightly different direction, Mr. Donovan raised some questions about in the rebuttal argument and that it's misconduct for the prosecutor to refer to Mr. you know, lack of action on the part of Mr. Jimenez in the last 2 years and what could he have done? What is he supposed to have done? The defense argument is clear in this case. It's my guy didn't have the intent to defraud the quick funds company. That was the theory of the case, and it's directly relevant. If your defense is my guy didn't have the intent to defraud the company, and he never got the letter from the quick funds saying that your check balanced and you need to repay us the money, then it is directly relevant that having learned of the fact that your check balanced, you didn't take any steps to respond to that check in any way, try and recoup the loss of the quick funds company. So I think that that statement that Mr. Donovan pointed to in closing is not erroneous at all. And Your Honors, if you would find any error in any of the statements that the prosecutor made, I don't think that that Jimenez can show that any of the alleged errors affected his substantial rights. There was significant evidence of Jimenez's guilt in this case. Really, of course, the only thing that was disputed was whether or not the check was forged and whether or not he had offered the check with the intent to defraud. The evidence shows some of those comments that the prosecutor was talking about in closing about the he thinks it's from his employer. He tells Quick Funds he thinks this is from his employer, but he admits that he doesn't remember if there's anything on the check or the letter, I believe, was his testimony that indicated that it was from his employer. This is the only check from his employer that he in fact cashes at Quick Funds. And then there's the whole question of the address that he provides. He provides Quick Funds with an address that is not the address where he's living at the time. So that's also, there's a lot of evidence here for the jury to be thinking about when they're considering if he's guilty or not, especially his own testimony. They were able to view his credibility and clearly determine that he was not credible his testimony that he basically made a stupid mistake and assumed this was legitimate was not credible. So I think the state's evidence in this case, Your Honor, is strong. The closing was, this is a short case, 1 day trial, closing arguments, I think are less than 20 pages in total. Again, I think the core of the comments that Mr. Donovan and maybe the court might find problematic are actually very small. It's maybe a one sentence or one something that could have been phrased a little better or could have been raised in a slightly different way. I don't think that raises to the level of being pervasive such as to merit reversal. And in fact, most of the arguments that the defense objects to happened in the opening the first closing argument. The defense counsel was able to respond to, and in fact did respond to most of those arguments in his response. And of course, then we have the case law that's strong on the issue of the burden of proof. And if the jury is correctly instructed on the burden of proof, and they got all those instructions in this case, just like Judge Connolly was talking about with Mr. Donovan, they got the instructions of the attorneys, you know, the attorney's arguments aren't evidence. What is evidence is what did you hear from the witnesses. So I think all of those factors in total show that Jimenez's substantial rights were not impacted in this case. Unless your honors have any further questions, the state would ask that the court affirm Mr. Jimenez's conviction. Thank you.
No, appears not. Thank you very much, counsel. And rebuttal, Mr. Donovan.
Thank you. Just a couple of very brief points. One, there's discussion of the race case, and yes, this is confusing. I think one thing to sort of keep in mind, contrasting, comparing race versus Johnson, which I discuss in my reply. In race, there's the theory that maybe the life raft was vandalized. There's no opening statement, and the defendant doesn't testify. What that is a defense counsel standing up and closing and sort of saying, I don't know, maybe this. I think that's fair game. When you have a case like Johnson, where the defendant gets up, testifies that was about a DWI, and says, you know what, I drank some beers, but I wasn't intoxicated. It was Addison's disease. That's why I was acting this way. And then the prosecutor got up and said, there's no evidence about Addison's disease, and that's how it makes you appear and seem. That was misconduct, because he's introduced this theory, and they're saying you needed to present more evidence to support your theory. I think that's how we sort of look at these cases. He's presented this theory. He's testified. He doesn't need to present more.
Judge Larkin.
Can I ask a question, Judge Larkin, here? We're under a plain error standard of review, correct? Because there was no objection to these statements at trial?
Correct.
All right. What I'm struggling with as I listen to everybody sort of dissect the cases, and it's like, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, where's the line, this is maybe okay, this is not okay. How in that context would we conclude that this was plain error, clear and obvious? But what's your best authority for that conclusion?
It is both race and Johnson, because even though race didn't find that there was misconduct, there is a clear statement that it is misconduct for a prosecutor to comment on a defendant's failure to present evidence. Johnson says the same thing. Those are clear statements of law. Even if they don't find in one misconduct or two reversible misconduct, they still say that that is misconduct.
Are there other cases, though, where the objected to or objectionable statements did reference production of evidence and court said, well, this wasn't misconduct?
The cases that I have found that say it's not misconduct are, A, there are a lot of pre-Ramey cases, which really sort of changed the entire analysis for unobjected to prosecutorial misconduct. And two, it's normally they're looking at the Caron standard and saying, well, if you give an instruction and you don't object, that's usually okay then, before Ramey sort of changed the outline here. So I think that Race and Johnson both very clearly stand for this proposition.
And may I ask, just to be clear on this, and what you think is plain error. So if the testimony was, there was a letter, you know, I got a letter, it was on my employer's letterhead. It clearly said, encloses a legit check that please cash for the phone, you know, for your hours, whatever. And describes it in detail, and then is asked, where's the letter? And he says, it's sitting at home, to my desk at home. And then it's never produced. What can the prosecutor say in closing about that?
The prosecutor can, again, discuss the letter itself, but it can't ask, where is it? It can't put into the jury's mind,
Can it say that the defendant testified the letter is at home?
Yes.
Or would that suggest that, oh, they should think, oh, that letter's at home, it's not here? You know, I mean, it's just, we're like, there's all these inferences, because as you say, the quiet part out loud, I mean, people are trying to figure out, is it credible testimony about the letter? And what the defendant is entitled to is a fair trial, including on the burden with the appropriate burden of proof. But I don't know if, like, it seems a little tricky to say, well, yeah, sure, they're thinking that, but don't say it out loud when you're trying to figure out whether it's a credible testimony about that letter. Is that what we're trying to figure out here?
Sure. And when you say that quiet part out loud, that's when it's misconduct. Which you said on the defendant testified he had a letter and it's at home is an accurate statement of the defendant's testimony. It's not going to be misconduct when it's an accurate statement of their testimony.
Even though it would clearly suggest to the jury, again, about where that letter is. It's not in front of your interested eyes.
You want them to think that, but you can't go ahead and invite them to think that. I think that's the difference, is saying, let's start looking at where it is.
So what a prosecutor should do in that circumstance is, he testified that the letter's at home. And then there should be this long pause. While everybody
does not appear
that
in the transcript, because I can't see the
just
pauses.
Long pause. And then the prosecutor should just say, use your common sense. So that would be kosher. Is that right?
I think I got a lot tougher argument there. I mean, but no, again, if it's an accurate statement of his testimony, and again, we'll never know. I'd love to see a court reporter put long pause, trial resume 2 minutes later. But if it's just that,
or maybe it should be long pause with a glance at the defendant, you know.
We're really getting into stage directions in these.
Yeah. Well, I'm just I want to give good law and make sure what you can and can't do. So I'll draw a chart if I can get my colleagues to agree that a chart is appropriate here. I don't know. We'll see.
I had more points. I see I'm out of time. We'll just ask that you please reverse the conviction.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time frame.